Welcome to the Omfit Podcast.
Hello, this is Mark Sobel. I'm the U.S. Chair of OMFIF. Today, I have the great honor and joy of being joined by four longtime colleagues and friends to discuss emerging markets, capital flows, the Federal Reserve, and I hope whether we'll have another taper tantrum. I'm joined today by Ottaviano Canuto. There's so much to say about him. He's been a senior Brazilian economic official, a senior World Bank and IDB official, and the Brazilian representative at the World Bank. And then the IMF, where I got to know him pretty well. David Lubin is a senior emerging market economist for Citigroup. Ratna Sahai has held senior positions throughout the entirety of the IMF and is now the deputy department head in the Monetary and Capital Markets Division. And last but not least, Steve Kamen, longtime career Fed staffer, headed the International Financial Division, I think from around 2011 to 2020. He briefed the FOMC, led the Fed's global forecasting, and he managed relations with the G20 and G7 finance processes. He's now a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, among many other activities. So I'm going to start off by giving each of you six minutes, to offer some thoughts on the following questions, and then I'll come back to each of you in a second round, give you 2 minutes or so to comment on what you've heard from the others. We'll then turn to audience questions. The audience can submit questions via the Q&A function at the bottom of the page. All right. So, Ottaviano, Geeta Gopinath warned the other day that EMs cannot afford another taper tantrum. You just wrote a piece for the Brookings Institution entitled, "Will Another Taper Tantrum Hit Emerging Markets?" What did you conclude?
All right. First of all, thank you. Thank you, Mark, for having me here and in such a great company. I, in fact, approached the hypothesis that the forthcoming U.S. monetary policy change, most likely the tapering now expected to start before the end of the year, followed by basic interest rate hikes later, might bring a repeat of the 2013 taper tantrum experience for emerging market economies, or of the 2018 May storm that hit Argentina and Turkey. Well, in February and March of this year, 2021, we had the U.S. long-term rates slightly rising in anticipation that the Fed might soon start tightening its monetary policy. U.S. President Joe Biden's large fiscal package sparked new fears about inflation and economic overheating. The 10-year Treasury yields rose from below 1.2% to close to 1.8% before, obviously, stabilizing and falling back to previous levels afterwards. The Fed has managed to keep markets cool by promising to give plenty of advance notes before beginning to taper its monthly bond purchase. But in July, we had an even shorter tantrum after the release of a more hawkish configuration of dot plots by FOMC members, but it waned. Since then, interest rates have declined at a notable pace. We even had a decline of interest rates after Mr. Powell's signal in Jackson Hole that tapering is likely to start before the end of the year. The 10-year Treasury bills fell from 1.34%, the yield, on Thursday, 26 to 1.29% yesterday. But uncertainties remain for emerging markets, most of which suffered capital flight as a result of the February-March short or little tantrum, if you like, and the expected hike in U.S. market interest rates. Although those outflows have reversed since then, the result is a possibility that the Fed will feel obliged to change tack, leaving open the question of whether we are heading for another taper tantrum of the kind that shook global markets in 2013. Recall that in June of 2013, then Fed Chair Ben Bernanke suggested that the FOMC might soon start to slow down its bond purchase. With that one passing statement, Bernanke unwittingly triggered a wave of interest rate hikes and capital flight from emerging markets. At the time, the fragile five, South Africa, Brazil, India, Indonesia, and Turkey, had high current account deficits and a strong dependence on inflows of foreign capital. For years, then, they had experienced the spillover effects of ultra-loose U.S. monetary policies, which sent investors seeking higher yields in emerging markets. When Bernanke raised the possibility of gradual monetary policy tightening, investors briefly panicked. Well, another bout of capital outflows from emerging markets occurred in May 2018. The main storm, the Fed had started to taper QE3, but this tapering, followed by a sell-off in U.S. bond markets and dollar appreciation, was halted in 2019, but not before affecting specifically two emerging markets. This time, the Fragile 5 had been reduced to the Fragile 2 of Turkey and Argentina, which both had high current account deficits and an acute vulnerability to exchange rate fluctuations, owing to their large volumes of foreign currency debt. Let me remark that currency mismatch was key in May 2018. If you look at the figures of Chile at the time, the levels of external finance were relatively higher than in Argentina, but Chile had a good currency match between the corporates issuing bonds and their revenues in dollars. Okay, but this brings us back to this year. And in fact, according to the tracking by the IIF, the February-March market tantrum was enough to generate a significant reduction in non-resident portfolio flows to emerging markets. The second quarter was smoother. The asset class almost fully retraced its loss from the first quarter. It all obviously helped that the U.S. Treasury bond volatility declined and the U.S. dollar weakened. But worries of a taper tantrum 2.0 will remain salient over the next 2 years, especially if it starts to look like the Fed would be obliged to tighten faster than what it is currently projected. But it's important to remember, and I go to my objective, that we're no longer in 2013. Back then, the Fragile 5's current account deficit averaged around 4.4% of GDP, compared to just 0.4% today. Moreover, the flow of external resources into emerging markets in recent years has been nowhere close to or as large as in the years before the 2013 tantrum. Nor are real exchange rates as overvalued as they were then. On the contrary, at least in the case of Brazil. Except for Turkey, the Fragile 5's gross external financing needs as a proportion of foreign reserves have fallen substantially. Of course, Argentina has been out of flows, and last week's SDR allocation will give it some space to muddle through until next year for closing some agreement with the IMF. But if you look at the IMF emerging market reserve adequacy, and, you know, let me mention Brazil, Indonesia, South Africa, Chile, Colombia, India, Mexico, Russia, Thailand, Philippines, and obviously China, they have all maintained, they have acquired reserve adequacy ratios quite much higher than it was the case in 2013. They're all above the IMF prescribed level. And two additional mitigating factors have also been suggested by analysts. First, if stronger economic growth drives up U.S. interest rates, positive trade linkage for some emerging markets might help offset any negative financial spillover. Although last week at Jackson Hole, a paper presented by Gorinches and colleagues kind of put doubt on the negative financial spillover being outweighed by the trade effect. But the second mitigating factor is worth considering, which is the fact that apparently now, the Fed has been offering a more appropriate signaling this time around, thereby minimizing the risk of another panic episode. Okay, then you could ask about the problem of twin debts. There is also the fiscal side. One cannot dismiss the fact that the emerging markets suffered large capital outflows last year, just as their fiscal debts were rising in response to the pandemic. But despite the COVID-19 crisis, emerging markets generally have been able to finance their larger fiscal debts by relying on domestic investors and, in some cases, their central banks. 18 emerging markets launched limited public bond or private security purchase programs, QE in emerging markets, with different types, of course. Chile and Poland, because their monetary conditions were quite close to the ones of the advanced economies. India, a little bit taking risks, in some other cases less so. But the fact of the matter is that to a large extent, the emerging markets crossed the need for the fiscal debt financing maybe more easily than what many expected. My point is, ultimately, the bigger risks facing emerging markets lie elsewhere. Of course, any abrupt shift in U.S. monetary policy would have systemic consequence. But rather than worrying about another taper tantrum, we should be more concerned with the relatively slower pace of immunizations in some emerging markets, leading to an anemic post-pandemic recovery. The concerns are as well with the inflationary impacts of commodity price hikes. Commodity price hikes are good for commodity-dependent countries, but given the fact that they have not been accompanied by overvaluation of currency of most emerging markets, we have watched rising costs of food baskets in local currency. Brazil is a typical case. But the central banks are responding. Brazil, Russia, Hungary, Mexico, Peru have all changed the tack of domestic interest rates. And there are also other risks. Brazil faces a humongous hydro energy crisis with inflationary impacts and possibly rationing before the end of the year. And this is already feeding up inflation in Brazil. And there is also a widespread perception of risks in Latin America stemming from politics and social discontent. Of the three major emerging market regions, Latin America suffered by far the worst human and economic toll. So Mark, that would be, let's say, overall the points that I tried to highlight in my piece. Thank you.
Great. And we can come back to some of that later. But okay, 2021 is not 2013, is what I'm hearing from you. David, floor is yours, your take on the situation. And it would be great if you could drill down for us. There will be tapering, ultimately perhaps rate hikes. Advanced economy fiscal support won't continue as it has. And so what does that mean for EM and the question of a taper tantrum? And maybe you could offer us some thoughts on what countries you see as vulnerable to reduce macro accommodation from advanced economies. What countries seem ironclad? It seems to me at Latin America, as Ottaviano just said, suggested, and some Mideastern countries seem more likely to face stress than Asia and East Europe in general. Floor is yours, David.
Thank you very much, Mark. Thanks very much for the invitation to take part in this. There's almost nothing about what Ottaviano said that I want to contradict. I just want to make a couple of adjustments to some of the ideas. And maybe one way of starting is to go back to the two big sell-offs that, you know, market participants can remember, the 2013 sell-off, the taper tantrum, and then the other one that Ottaviano mentioned, the spring 2018 sell-off. Now, the conventional way of explaining the run-up to these emerging market sell-offs, these capital outflows that were fairly devastating for a number of countries, is just to refer to changes in the structure of U.S. monetary conditions. In other words, you know, the rise real nominal US interest rates. However, I think that in order to really understand the sell-offs in 2013 and 2018, there is something about China that also needs to be brought into the analysis. Namely, that on both of those occasions, in 2013 and in 2018, China was in a process of withdrawing credit stimulus from its domestic economy. And that, in effect, created a sort of double whammy for emerging economies. In other words, not only were they suffering on the capital account of the balance of payments because of a tightening of U.S. financial conditions, but they were also suffering on the current account of the balance of payments because China withdrawing credit stimulus from its domestic economy in a pursuit of trying to cap leverage ratios across the domestic economy, therefore delivers a negative shock to the current account of emerging markets' balance of payments, because China for the last 10 years has been the weather maker in the global investment cycle. And since the global investment cycle is very influential in shaping the global trade cycle and in shaping the global commodity cycle, when China withdraws stimulus from its domestic economy, that delivers a big negative shock to the global investment cycle. And so I think it's not just the tightening of US monetary conditions that you need to look at to understand those episodes, but also what was going on in China at the time too. And I say all this just to make the case that actually, if all of what I just said is true, you can come up with a story to say that that's exactly what we've got at the moment. In other words, we're kind of, you know, heading towards a tapering process, which should, other things equal, raise nominal and real US yields. Although, as Ottaviano mentioned, we haven't really seen that yet. The real 10-year US Treasury yield is still minus 100 basis points or so. And the slowdown in China, about which I can say more, but for time's sake, I'll keep it brief. The slowdown in China arguably is creating a negative external shock for emerging economies that is, you know, more or less similar to the negative external shocks that they were experiencing both in 2013 and in 2018. And we've already seen, for example, commodity prices coming off their highs in the last couple of months. And I suspect that one of the central reasons for that decline in commodity prices is the slowdown that's taking place in China. So I think it's both decisions made in Washington and decisions made in Beijing that together shape the external environment for emerging markets. On the question of how much more protected EM is today compared to, for example, the 2013 taper tantrum, I completely agree with what Ottaviano was saying. And I think it's obviously in particular worth emphasizing the fact that emerging economies' external financing requirements these days are, as Ottaviano said, very, very small compared to 2013. And that really is the crucial point, because financial vulnerability in emerging markets is basically consists in a country needing dollars from the rest of the world to finance itself at a time when the rest of the world is just unwilling to supply those dollars. That is, you know, that is the definition of an emerging markets crisis. But because current account deficits are so small these days, emerging economies by and large have very limited need for external funding, and that makes them much more resilient to the consequences of any upward shock to US Treasury yields or any further strengthening of the US dollar. I would also say that another factor that I think helps to protect emerging markets at the moment is, in a funny kind of way, the idea that you can describe emerging market policymakers these days as conducting a much more conventional type of macro policy than is the case in the developed world. I mean, this is most obviously visible in monetary policy, where Brazil, Russia, Mexico, Ukraine, Peru, Chile, the Czech Republic, Hungary, I'm sure I'm missing a bunch out, you know, have all begun the process, in some cases quite aggressively, of raising interest rates. One of the consequences of that very conventional approach to monetary policy, in other words, withdrawing the crisis, the pandemic era stimulus, is that the real interest rate differential between EM and DM, and developed markets, has started to climb. So, for example, back in December last year, for commodity exporting emerging economies, the inflation adjusted policy rate in their countries minus the inflation adjusted policy rate in advanced economies was about 110 basis points. Today, that's closer to 140 basis points. So real, in other words, the real interest rate differential has gone up, And that's true also for manufacturing exporters in EM in sort of medium term. So the fact that the interest rate differential has been rising is something that also helps to kind of protect the capital account of these countries' balance of payments at a time when this kind of double whammy of China and the US may be creating a more hostile external environment.
Great. Thank you for that. Good observations. So I'm going to turn to Ratna, maybe a little bit more theoretical here, but you worked a lot on this IMF's new integrated policy framework. It tries to optimize the combination of countries' monetary and macroprudential policies, foreign exchange intervention, and capital flow measures based on the country's specific costs and benefits. It strikes me as something that's predicated on the notion that the impossible trinity can detrimentally push countries towards exchange rate flexibility in the presence of dominant currency pricing and capital market imperfections. And Helene Ray posits that whenever capital is freely mobile, the global financial cycle constrains national monetary policies, regardless of the exchange rate regime. I see the two of the IPF and Helene Ray's dilemma going hand in hand. So what is this work meant for the current EM environment and for the post-pandemic environment? It doesn't seem to me that countries have wanted to revert to too many capital controls or tons of intervention as the IPF might have suggested, but what are your thoughts on this?
Thank you very much, Mark, first for inviting me, and it's really stimulating already as I hear my colleagues speak. The IMF has come out, as you know, with a new, what we call an integrated policy framework, IPF. Just starting with your last question, you know, what does it mean for the post-pandemic EM environment? I would say that this framework is valid for any shock that leads to global easing or tightening of financial conditions. So following the continued easing of U.S. monetary policy in response to the pandemic, non-U.S. countries have used monetary policy, macroprudential policy, and some FX intervention. Indeed, CFMs, as you mentioned, or the capital flow measures, have not been used as much. But let me say that they have been used more than during the taper tantrum. And this is mainly, we observe them in smaller countries which have large services sector like tourism. So let me just briefly, talk a little bit about the IPF. So what is it about? So really, starting from, Ellen Ray's point, it recognizes that cross-border capital flows provide significant benefits to recipient countries, no question, but may also generate, negative spillovers, and such as the risks to domestic financial stability. So the traditional answer, and IMF has also said that in the past, has been to use flexible exchange rates as a shock absorber. However, what we found is that flexible exchange rates may not offer full insulation from external shocks, and this is due to capital market imperfections. For example, financial markets, whether denominated in FX or even in local currency, when they are shallow, it creates problems. And of course, as everybody knows, there are, FX mismatches in balance sheets. That also creates a problem. So given these circumstances, what we observed is that policymakers have deployed, and in our framework, we agree that they should deploy a mix of tools, the four that you mentioned, and depending on their particular circumstances. And why is that? Does that make sense? It's because, in the past, when there was a lot of capital inflow, countries tightened monetary policy, and that simply invited more inflows. Many countries didn't have the luxury of FX interventions because they simply didn't have sufficient FX reserves. So this framework is kind of new in the sense of including also two other tools, which is macroprudential policy and VFMs. So let me just make the case, first of all, what happens when financial conditions are loose and what do you observe in these countries? So if you turn to slide one, so in So with my co-authors, Steve Cicchetti, Machiko, and Umang, we looked at a sample of 950 banks and non-bank financial firms across about 30 non-US economies. These also included, by the way, not just EMs, but also small advanced economies. And this is for the past two decades. So what this chart shows you is the buildup of leverage of financial firms, as you can see, banks, insurance, real estate, etc., asset management companies, before and after sustained easing of US monetary policy, where US easing, of course, led to capital inflows in these countries. So what we see here is that the leverage of non-US firms tends to increase as capital flows into non-US countries during prolonged US monetary policy easing. What was really interesting that we found in this particular study is that this increase in leverage tends to be much larger because of US monetary easing than the impact of their own domestic monetary policy easing. So the strength of US monetary policy easing, however you want to think about it, is much higher. And of course, we also then looked at the policies, and our regression results found that if policymakers are able to implement macroprudential policies, FX intervention, CFMs, the financial institutions do not increase their leverage as much as they otherwise. And we also looked at the impact if you do it ex ante versus during the episode. We found that it's much more difficult to counter the spillovers if you have reactive policies rather than preemptive policies. So that kind of reinforces our message that you should try and use these four tools. So let me turn to this next slide. So this was a case where, there were capital inflows. So let's now cover the other side when financial conditions begin to tighten and capital outflows are likely. So in this slide, this is a slide that I also co-authored with Gaston, Lucy, Robin, and Sylvia recently. Again, these are all recent papers prepared in the context of the IPF work that we did. So here we look at the whole distribution of capital inflows and outflows. So at zero, there is no inflow or outflow. And this is a chart that basically we estimate what is the probability in the future of capital inflow. So here we forecast not just the mean, but the full distribution of capital flows, both outflow and inflows. And we, using data from about 20 countries, basically what this chart shows, the impact of easing macroprudential policies in the face of tightening financial conditions. So the red distribution is one where there's no easing measures, and you can see that the mean is closer to zero than the blue distribution where macroprudential policies are used. And in fact, we also found that the probability of outflow decreases. So empirically, we found that the probability of capital outflows falls from 5% to about 10% if you have already implemented easing macro measures. And the final slide is something that's on top of many people's mind. But the previous two slides, the main point I want to make, that IPF tools can be effective in mitigating the negative effects of an external shock. The final chart is really about CFMs. So you might ask, but use such policies, especially CFMs, which is somewhat controversial, surely it must hurt EMs in terms of their credibility, credit ratings, etc. So what we did, and this is in a third paper, we did an investor survey, and also conducted some empirical analysis. And here we found, as this slide shows, this is a slide that shows the average rating of countries with and without outflow controls introduced during a crisis. And we go from T minus one to T plus nine, where T is really a quarter. So what we found is that countries introducing outflow controls during crisis indeed experienced a downgrade of ratings, and we use Standard & Poor's in this case. But this was only true in the short term. Okay, and it was quite large, actually. It was twice as large as countries not implementing these controls. However, within 9 quarters, the average ratings, if you look at T plus 9, of both groups seemed to converge, which we found quite interesting, that it really didn't seem to matter whether you had imposed controls or not after a point in time. So the conclusion that I draw from this is that investors seem to be forgiving, and really there is no long-term impact. In fact, the survey actually that we conducted, and this we were really surprised, there were over 70 participants or so, it indicated that nearly 50% would be back into the country within 1 year of imposing the controls. So let me just stop there. Thank you very much, Mark.
Great. Thank you. And I should have noted you're awake in India late at night. And thank you, especially given that, for joining us. So, Steve, last but not least, you just wrote a Fed Notes piece with some of your ex-colleagues, now ex-colleagues, and how to think about Fed spillovers on EMs. And I'd like to hear about that and how the persistent versus transitory inflation debate plays into that. And given what Ratna just said, how do you think about the global financial cycle and how much of a challenge emanates from the Fed or from other EM factors? And if you want to tell us whether there's going to be a taper tantrum too in your 6 minutes, feel free. So floor is yours, Steve.
Thanks, Mark. I appreciate having the opportunity to share my views and also to learn a lot, which I've already done, from my extremely knowledgeable co-panelists. So I'm going to start not by talking about two historical episodes, the 2013 and 2018 episodes. I'm going to talk actually about the early 80s and the early 2000s. So I'm going to start by noting that during the Volcker disinflation of the early 80s, monetary policy by the Fed, tightening by the Fed, you know, appeared to lead to financial crises and a lost decade for Latin America. Whereas when the Fed tightened, raised rates between 2004 and 2006, nothing happened. Emerging market economies or EMEs continue to thrive. So what was the difference between those two episodes? Well, to answer that question and address this issue of spillovers more generally, my, as you point, called them they're ex-Fed colleagues or not Fed ex-colleagues, Jasper Hoke and Emery Yoldis and I analyze the impact of changes in interest rates after FOMC meetings on emerging markets. And we focused on two factors. The first was whether Fed tightening was in response to stronger U.S. economic growth prospects, or whether it was in response to higher inflation, or maybe just a hawkish shift in the Fed strategy. And we called the first kind of tightening a growth shock, and identified that as a situation where both interest rates and the stock market went up after an FOMC meeting. And we figured that that would probably be good for emerging markets, or at least benign, because higher U.S. growth means higher imports and then happier and less risk-averse global investors. And that was kind of the situation that Ottaviano alluded to earlier. Then we called the second kind of tightening a monetary shock. And we identified that as happening when interest rates went up, but the stock market went down. And that would likely be bad for EMEs since it would restrain U.S. growth in imports and darken investor sentiment. So that was one factor. The second factor determining the nature of spillovers from Fed policy was basically the financial and macro vulnerability of the EMEs themselves. And that's also something that all our other commentators have referred to. And so kind of toward that, we assessed the vulnerability of 22 EMEs based on indicators like current accounts, reserves, debt, inflation, and credit growth. All right, now, Ben, if we can see the slide, which will show the results of our analysis, okay? And it focuses on demonstrating the effect of a 100 basis point increase in the 10-year U.S. Treasury yield after an FOMC meeting. So if you look at the top left panel, okay, the first two bars focus on low vulnerability EMEs like Korea or Taiwan. And as you can see, in response to a growth shock, and that's the blue bar, the EME currency actually rises against the dollar historically in our sample. Okay. On the other hand, looking at the red bar, in response to a monetary policy shock at the, in the United States, the EME currency actually declines nearly by 10%. Now let's look at what happens in a high vulnerability economy like Brazil or Turkey. As you can see, the growth shock, the blue bar, is still benign. The currency really doesn't move much. But the red bar, the monetary policy shock, shows the EME currency falling nearly 20%. And the remaining three panels in this slide tell the same story. Spillovers to emerging markets are usually benign when the Fed tightens in response to strong growth. But when the Fed tightens in response to inflation, credit spreads rise, bond yields rise, and equities plunge. And that's all the more true for emerging markets with poor fundamentals. Okay. And this explains why the Fed tightening in the early 2000s was so much less adverse for emerging markets than during the bulk of disinflation. The later tightening was mainly in response to stronger growth prospects, and EMEs had improved their fundamentals a lot by then. So this analysis helps us understand, and Ben, can we go to the next slide, the implications of different scenarios for U.S. inflation going forward in a framework I call the good, the bad, and the ugly. Okay. So what Mr. Eastwood is telling us, as far as the good scenario goes, is that if inflation goes back down next year, just like Chair Powell has promised, then the Fed will hold off on tightening for a while longer, and most emerging markets should be fine, at least as far as Fed policy goes. As Ottaviano pointed out, there's plenty of other problems that emerging markets will be dealing with, not the least of which is the pandemic. On the other hand, switching to the bad scenario, if inflation rises further and stays there for the next several years, the Fed's going to have to tighten a lot quicker than most market participants expect. And that will plunge U.S. markets and the U.S. economy into disarray and recession. And that will certainly be bad for emerging markets. And I would say for the broad, spectrum of emerging markets. Now, I'm not super worried about the bad scenario. I don't see why the pandemic shock should lead to a sustained rise in inflation, for many years. I am more worried about the ugly scenario, okay, where inflation stays high temporarily, kind of like at least into part of next year. The Fed sticks to its dovish guns because it really is certain that inflation is going to come back down. But the bond markets aren't so sure, and they freak out at least temporarily, until there's some evidence of genuine disinflation is happening. So under those circumstances, there should be a lot of financial turbulence, but maybe not recession in the United States. But I do expect big problems, at least for the most vulnerable emerging markets, certainly Turkey, Brazil, South Africa, et cetera. Finally, I want to note that all these three scenarios, okay, are separate from the prospect of the Fed starting to taper its QE. That's going to happen later this fall, just like Chair Powell pretty much said it would. And I'm guessing it will have little or no effect on emerging markets, since that's been fully discounted by the markets. But in the interest of full disclosure, I will note that I said the exact same thing in the spring of 2013. So we'll just have to see, and I'll stop there.
Well, thank you. And just looking at Steve's background, just to tell the audience, he's in North Arlington, Virginia, not in Graceland. We're getting some good questions in. I told everybody you get a chance to react to whatever the other said. David held best to his 6 minutes, so I'm going to start with him. Just reactions to anything you heard that really got your attention. But secondly, we're getting in some good questions about, the environment for emerging markets may not be as favorable going forward as in 2021, in the sense that rates are going to go higher in the U.S., commodity prices may go down, global growth may slow. Have you in your own city analyses factored that into your outlook for EM, and is it a pretty picture, or do you see tensions and problems and managing that. So I would, that was one interesting question we got. Mm. And then just for all of you, I'm going to go David, Ottaviano, Ratna, and Steve. But another just interesting question we're getting is about, given the rise of local currency debt, foreigners have piled into that. There can be runs from that if the foreigners get spooked and leave. Is that a factor on your mind? Anyway, anything you would like to tell us for a few minutes, please. Sure. The floor is yours.
Thanks, Mark. In fact, let me pick up on that last point because it fits in with a point that I think is becoming interesting and hasn't really generated a lot of discussion yet. And it's a question about what happens to China's capital account against the background of US monetary tightening. The one important difference between, you know, whatever happens in the next few months versus 2013 or 2018 is that hundreds of billions of dollars of portfolio capital have entered China. And, you know, foreign ownership of the Chinese government bond market is closer to 10% of the stock these days than 2% of the stock, which is where it was four or five years ago. So the question that I think is interesting is, well, first of all, there's a question about whether Chinese policymakers have a kind of dilemma. On the one hand, the economy, as we all know, is slowing. That argues, in theory at least, for lower yields across the Chinese curve. But there's a question whether if Chinese yields do fall, whether they fall below some currently invisible threshold below which foreign portfolio managers who own Chinese government bonds think that the spread of Chinese government bond yields over US Treasury yields is insufficiently attractive to keep them in China, and they want to buy dollars and do something else with their money. In other words, one new twist to the international consequences of tapering or the international consequences of US monetary tightening could be a capital outflow from China, which could be quite uncomfortable, or at least, you know, it can present some difficulties, you know, particularly for Asian economies. If the renminbi has to weaken as a result of those capital outflows, that's a kind of new set of questions that we haven't had to struggle with in the past that I think could be very, very interesting. And actually, this idea of, you know, the thinking about the portfolio capital that's gone into China sort of fits in with one of the questions that you posed, namely, you know, the sort of consequences for local government market, local bond markets across EM. And I would say that actually one of the generalizations I think it's possible to make over the last few years is that foreign portfolio managers have fallen out of love with local currency bond markets in EM. In South Africa, in Brazil, in Mexico, in Indonesia, in Poland, in Hungary, you can see that in all of those local government bond market, local currency denominated bond markets, foreign participation has fallen, either in value terms or certainly in percentage terms. In other words, the share of the total bond market owned by foreigners has declined. Now, some people argue that the reason for that is China, you know, that, in other words, portfolio managers have sold their Mexican government bonds and have bought Chinese government bonds instead. So China, to some extent, has kind of caused some redistribution of portfolio inflows into local currency bond markets. However, I think that an equally important, maybe a better explanation for why portfolio managers seem to have fallen out of love with local currency bond markets in EM has to do with changing perceptions of potential growth in EM. If you lose confidence about country X's potential growth rate, then you will also tend to lose confidence about the prospect for that currency's currency to appreciate. And if you can't be confident that a country's currency will appreciate over time, what are you doing buying their local currency denominated bonds? So I think that it's the link between declining potential growth in EM, giving rise to less confidence about the capacity for emerging markets currencies to strengthen over time, which in turn makes portfolio managers at the margin a bit less enthusiastic about owning these currencies, local currency bond markets. So I think that is a sort of general story. Now, that to some extent has been a problem for countries like South Africa or Brazil. In other words, if you're running large budget deficits and you've got a large public debt stock, losing access to foreigners willing to lend you money in your own currency is bad news. And earlier this year, and certainly late last year, I was very worried about, you know, the problems that Brazil or South Africa might face as a result of having very large debt stocks, very large domestic financing needs at a time when they seem to have lost access to this pool of international capital. Now, those concerns at the moment have kind of taken a back seat because, you know, Brazilian growth is still going to be, you know, the recovery in countries like Brazil and South Africa this year is much stronger than I thought it would be several months ago. Having said that, I think it won't be too long before we return to worrying about what you can sometimes describe as the R minus G problem in these countries. In other words, that these countries, Brazil and South Africa particularly, have real inflation adjusted bond yields that are significantly higher than any reasonable estimate of these countries' potential growth rates. And that R minus G problem, you know, the real interest rate higher than the real growth rate, is not great news for public sector debt dynamics. And I do think that we will, even though these countries have been bailed out by the global recovery and the rise in commodity prices in 2021, I don't think it'll be too long before we have to start worrying about them again.
Thank you for that. And just one further thing as we keep going on. I mean, the IMF used to tell us that an emerging market debt threshold was 70% of GDP. You know, how is that? Do we need to change our thinking on that? Ottaviano, what are your thoughts for us on anything?
First of all, fantastic talks by my colleagues. David hit the nail. China has to be brought in the picture. You cannot understand what has happened with the capital flows to emerging markets by not considering as well what happens in China. I would add the episode of 2015, the outflows of resources from China, which had a huge impact, particularly in Latin America and the Caribbean. So hit the nail. On his point about the, oh, and by the way, 2010, I co-wrote a book, espousing a very, with the benefit of hindsight, precautious thesis of the possibility of a switchover of global locomotives in the global economy. With the benefit of hindsight, we realized today how important was ended up being the China's rebalancing in the corresponding downgrade of growth rates in China that affected the whole economic emerging market growth rates. So China, the relevance of China in our discussion goes beyond that. On the original scene, and we should keep in mind that for several reasons, the picture changed a bit. For instance, today, which is something that if I had heard 5 years ago, I wouldn't believe, the share of foreign investors in holding public debt in Brazil is 9.5%, which is much lower than what one would expect some years ago. Of course, it's higher in Colombia and Chile, but the fact of the matter, and this matters because of the currency mismatch in balance sheets. Unratna, so great to hear. You all remember the fever that we all had, at least I committed the fever right after the global financial crisis. I even co-organized with Swati Ghosh a book on macro-pru and monetary policy. We thought that would be the way forward and so on, but it's kind of a waned a bit, the enthusiasm. Now we have it back. To some extent, one may say that Ellen Ray won the debate with Boris Obstfeld. Well, okay. But what I would like to call is the following. Also, thank you for the important results on the fading out of the negative signaling from capital controls. And we should keep in mind that capital controls outward or inward, is only one chapter of the macro pro advice. We should discuss more and get a little bit back to the enthusiasm that we had right after the global financial crisis. And Steve as well, great, fantastic. One point to make is that the weight of those two factors, the two effects, the growth and the monetary shock, will vary by country. Definitely, given the linkage, trade linkage of Mexico with the U.S., as compared to Brazil, where the impacts are more on the financial side, the result of the two effects will vary according to specific emerging markets. And finally, on tapering, you know, I may be wrong, but I have the impression that the tapering, coming tapering, is a non-event in the following sense. Clearly, judging by the plumbing that the Fed has had to make on selling back treasuries and so on, this idea of the plumbing is well developed by Manmohan Singh from the IMF. The QE went over what it would be necessary, to the point that the Fed has been obliged to unwind the QE by selling treasuries to devolving treasuries to the market because of lack of collateral and so on. So at the end of the day, we are having the continuity of the monthly bond purchases because of the commitments, but not really because they are functional for anything. And I think that's why I don't believe that the tapering in itself is a bad news in itself. Another thing is going to be the interest rate hikes. That's another story. But tapering, as far as I'm concerned, please correct me if I'm wrong, is a non-event. That's why the market is not paying so much attention.
Great. Non-event. That's a big word here. Ratna. Ratna, the floor is yours.
Thank you. Thank you, Mark. I mean, it was fantastic to hear from the panelists, and I completely agree with Ottaviano's assessment on the risks for the EMs going forward. Really, what we worry about at the IMF is much more about the debt of the low-income countries. That is a real issue. Of course, that's not the topic here, but that's where our focus is to some extent. So three points, Mark. One is, let me take a little bit of an issue with David, unless I misunderstood him. I'm spot on many of the arguments he made, bringing China into the picture, you know. So I led this 30-person team on the China FSAP about 2017-18. And it was, what was really fascinating is, of course, part of that financial sector assessment, sorry, let me spell that out, financial sector assessment program exercise, was to look at the spillovers, the financial spillovers from China to the rest of the world. And if you look at the direct spillovers, it's absolutely negligible. Nothing. China is pretty much a closed system. I mean, they have the biggest banks, big stock market, but most of them are really domestic. In fact, it's after one of our recommendations was to allow foreigners to enter the local bond market to diversify. So in the case of China, what really matters is the real spillovers, the trade spillovers. So if the trade spillover somehow affects the financial spillovers indirectly, then of course China matters, but not directly. So I believe that's still the case. I mean, you know, I finished that project in 2018. I mean, it'll be a while. The second point is the question you raised, Mark, about, you know, what is the debt threshold? We used to say 70%. I mean, if you remember, Bill Easterly said for emerging markets, it's 40%. For advanced economies, it's more, it's 60%. The facts are, Mark, if you look at the data and the empirics, what really matters is not just blank the level of debt. What matters is the capacity to service the debt. That's what investors are looking at. Do you have the capacity to service the debt? Doesn't matter what your debt is. And that seems to matter, at least in the empirical work that we've conducted. And that brings me to the last point about the local currency bond markets. It is indeed true that a number of governors very consciously decided to develop local currency bond markets just to get rid of the exchange rate risk. And what we do find is that if you look at countries where debt is more in local currency than FX, they seem to be less vulnerable. So it did pay off. And this point, David, that you raised, that, you know, that they are investing less, that may well be true, that the growth rate of investment in local currency debt by foreigners has gone down. But these markets have only been developing slowly over time. So the initial growth, which I would call a stock adjustment of the foreigners into the domestic market, that may have been very high, and over time you'd expect it to go down, you know, because you have a portfolio that you want to keep. And this is a pretty recent phenomenon, at least for not talking about South Africa and Brazil, but there are many other. Malaysia has really taken, developed this market. So the point I'm making is I think it's still safer for countries to have local currency bond markets than to have FX markets. So let me stop there. Thank you.
Great. I hope, if you guys won't mind, if we just run over a minute or two, I want to give the floor to Steve. And then I have a quick question for David.
Thanks, Mark. So a couple of points. On the domestic currency bond financing, you know, I think that it's, you know, got to be helpful at the margin, because it reduces the FX risk of any firms or governments that are issuing in local currency rather than in dollars. So, you know, probably got to be a good thing, but at least at this stage, certainly not a panacea. You know, if a country runs into a financial crisis, you know, all its asset markets, you know, are going to plunge. So it's still going to have exchange rate depreciation, still going to have capital outflows, credit rationing. So, as I say, no panacea, though helpful. And then an open question, I guess Ratna might know more about this than me, is, you know, if the country is depending more on domestic currency bond markets, and if those bond markets are less liquid than other markets, then it could actually take a bigger hit through that angle. So that's on that. I just wanted to also take a second to reference Ratna's super interesting slide, looking at how monetary ease in the States translates into more risk-taking abroad. And just to note that if we, the whole world, gets through this inflationary episode okay, in other words, inflation goes back down, the Fed's happy, we could be back in the low-for-long world we were in before the pandemic, and maybe even more so. And then the emerging markets would continue to accumulate debt, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So we could be in for an even worse crisis down the road, to be a little too provocative. So I'll stop there.
Well, thank you, Steve. And that is a perfect lead-in to what's going to be the last question for David. So first of all, there have been many comments and questions submitted by the audience. I thank you. This has been a fascinating discussion. Unfortunately, we're not going to be able to get to all of them. But last but not least, in a big picture question, and it picks up on what Steve just said. You know, I was talking to an emerging market analyst the other day, and this person basically said, with less accommodation going forward in advanced economies, there are going to be commodity prices may go down. It may be a dismal picture for emerging markets going forward. We had a question from the audience about, is there going to be a lost decade? Steve just suggested it. Maybe there's negativism ahead for emerging markets. David, do you have any comment on that theme and how Citi Group sees it?
Yes, I do, Mark. I think it's unfortunately worth being pessimistic about income convergence. In other words, the idea that, you know, per capita incomes in EM broadly converge with developed country per capita incomes. And the reason, and pessimistic compared to the last 30 years. And the reason I think that is that, you know, income convergence over the last few decades was overwhelmingly the result of a friendly relationship between, on the one hand, trade liberalization, you know, opening countries, opening themselves up to trade. And on the other hand, inflows of foreign direct investment. I think, you know, globalization defined as that, defined as the sort of synergistic relationship between trade liberalization and long-term capital inflows. That is what helps income convergence accelerate. And I fear that that synergistic relationship between trade openness and FDI inflows is breaking down. And it's breaking down because since 2012 already, there's inconsistent and increasing evidence of global protectionism. And I think also that the, you know, this kind of, if you like, economic nationalism that seems to be a function of policymaking in China with the dual circulation strategy, in Europe with the recovery and resilience facility, in the United States with this whole effort about supply chain resilience. I think that economic nationalism is very bad news for emerging markets growth prospects. I mean, there are other elements to the argument, you know, to be relatively pessimistic, you know, particularly in a number of countries like Brazil, where demographics over the past few decades have been very favorable. Going forward, they're not going to be favorable. They're certainly not going to be favorable in Central and Eastern Europe and in other parts of EM. So I guess if I sort of sum it up very bluntly, the combination of deglobalization or being beyond peak globalization together with weakening demographics is not great news for income convergence. And then there's another element which I think is worth mentioning, which, you know, goes back to the early discussion about the rise in public debt burdens in emerging economies. I mean, let me put it this way. If it was possible to be pessimistic about Brazil's long-term growth potential when the debt GDP ratio pre-pandemic was 75% of GDP, what should one's attitude to Brazil's potential growth be now that it's, you know, 85%+ of GDP? In other words, I think that the accumulation of public debt by itself ends up acting or creating some kind of tax on future growth potential.
Have we lost David?
No, I just stopped talking.
Okay, good. Thank you. You did it with great flair. And I think as we've alluded to and you've alluded to, I mean, when you throw on top of that potential growth low or slowing in advanced economies and a slowing China economy, it will probably further diminish the picture. We've run over time. This has been a fascinating conversation. We could probably go on and on if we wanted to or had the time. But Ratna has to go to bed. And I promised you 1 hour. So I thank the audience for joining us. I apologize for not getting to all of your questions. I thank Octaviano, David, Ratna, Steve for fantastic presentations and sharing their valuable time with us today. Thank you all, and have a pleasant day wherever you are.
Thank you for listening to the OMFIF podcast.